to our speaker tonight. Our speaker comes from Early to Rise Wilmington, Delaware group. Is that right?
Close enough.
Close enough, right. Well, you can correct me when you get up here. His name's Eric. Please give him a hand.
I'm Eric. I'm an alcoholic. I think I caused Lauren to have a heart attack. I just said a few minutes ago, I don't know what I'm going to talk about, and I saw her all stressed out. I've done this before, so I do know what I'm supposed to talk about. I'm from Early Risers. Is my home group. It meets Monday through Saturday at Triad, which is a location. It's its own district, actually, in AA, believe it or not. It's a little building in Wilmington. It's where one of the first meetings happened in the city. And I've been going there since I came out of rehab. My sobriety date is September 18, 2006. And before I came to AA, I drank every single day. And since I came to AA, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink. And I say that with no meaning of pride. It's all about humility. Before I came to AA, I drank every single day. And since I've come to AA, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink. So was it Eric that had anything to do with it? No. And I had nothing to do with this. Just qualify myself a little bit. I am a little bit of a strange bird now in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did a little bit of drugs, just very minor experimental in college. But it just wasn't worth the buck, right? I could buy a ton of booze in college, and it cost a fortune to get like even one line of cocaine, and it didn't give me any bang for my buck, so I tried it one or two times, and I never, did that again. Like I said, it was just easy to go to Kroger and buy generic beer as much as you could get, and that's what I needed. Also, I didn't drink until I got to college. So I'm not one of those people who said, you know, at age six I knew I was an alcoholic. I had no clue that I was. I have no excuses for why I'm an alcoholic. I wasn't diapered improperly. My parents were loving. I think I drove the people at rehab crazy because they try to figure out, you know, what's the precipitating event, right? And I have a sister who was my brother. She's transgendered. But that's not why I drank. It had nothing to do with it. It happened when I was in my 30s. We had six family deaths, including my mom, in a year and a half, and that didn't have anything to do with it. And I worked an extremely stressful job, and that didn't have anything to do with it either. What really happened with me is I lost total confidence in Eric. And alcohol helped me with that. Right? And so what happened with me was and this is why these are the things that I always knew. Self-knowledge and willpower have nothing to do with your recovery. If you think that you can, oh, now that I know what it is, I can do this. I used knowledge and willpower, and I created a very successful career for myself. And so knowledge and willpower has nothing to do with it. Because if you go to law school and you graduate with honors and you get a good job and you make partner in a big law firm, you clearly have knowledge. And you have to have willpower. You have to work many long hours. But it's just different when you get addicted to something. It's just knowledge and willpower have nothing to do with it. But what it really helped me do was I kept achieving things. And I just didn't feel like I should. Does anybody have like there's the facade in front of you? And if I let people know who I was, they would hate me. That was what I thought. Or I just got here. This is another thought. Think if you do this. Everything bad that happens, I deserve, and everything good that happened was luck, right? So I never earned anything. I was just happened to be the right guy in the right place at the right time, right? It wasn't that I worked really hard and achieved anything. I couldn't believe that about myself, right? But if something bad happened, it was all because of me. Like, I'm a loser, I'm immoral, whatever it is. I was quick to blame. And that, by the way, is a very unhealthy ego. Right? One of the things that in rehab that they forced us to do was just say thank you and you're welcome. Right? So if you go and do something for somebody and they say thank you, don't say, oh, it's no big deal, blah, 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 blah. Just say, you're welcome. Right? It was a big deal. So just say you're welcome. Right? But as an alcoholic, I couldn't do that. I just didn't have the feeling that I was good at what I did. Despite all evidence to the contrary. That's the delusion that I was in. So I'm going along, and I always remember I tell this story. I was drinking, and I was drinking heavier. One of the reasons I was drinking heavier was alcohol is my solution, right? So I come home, I work, you know, from 8 a.m. to say 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and I've got to start again tomorrow, right? When you come home and you do the type of work I was doing, you're not sleepy when you get home, right? You're jacked up. Like, you're like, it's fighting, it's litigating, it's big, what we call bet your company type of litigation. And I come home and I'd be like, you know, I have to go back at 8 a.m. Like, I have to get to sleep. So what I started out doing is I drink, you know, one scotch and water, and then two scotches and water, and then two scotches and a half because I'd fall asleep. And then eventually I'd start waking up and I'd drink the half. And it just, I drank myself into it, right? And this was the, and I kept drinking heavier and heavier. And I was in, and lawyers is an environment of drinking. We love to deny it. I always think, I do help out with what's called the Delaware Lawyer Assistance Programs. And they say that alcoholism and addiction is more prevalent in attorneys than it is in the normal population. Yet there are less people from that profession in Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous than most any profession. Just the amount of denial that goes on with it. So I'm drinking heavier and heavier. And I'm involved in this case. And I had gone and gotten the family liquor at lunch. And I had it in the back of the car. And my brother-in-law had turned me on to this where you get the flavored vodka, you know, like orange vodka. They have a million flavors. Now, I've never got a chance to taste any of them, unfortunately. But there was like the citron and whatever. And what you did is you get the orange, you cut an orange, you put it in, and you do tonic. It's a great summer drink. So I bought some of that, and the, you know, my wife drank gin. I also drank scotch. And I had it in the back of the car, and I was about to go to a really difficult meeting. And it was going to be a conference call, and I was going to be by myself in my office. And I sat there in the car and I thought, I'll just take a shot of vodka before I go up. Nobody will know. It'll relieve. You know, they do it on TV, right? Shot, takes the nerve. So I chugged a little vodka and the meeting went great. I did everything right in that meeting. I resolved every difficult situation, got everything I needed for my client. And my alcoholic mind, if one shot works well, two shots work even better. And that's when I really went off to the races. And that was when I really went off to the races. Because my brain equated relief from alcohol. And I'll get into the solution as quickly as I can. But one of the defining moments was I was going to an 11-step meeting because I followed directions. And I'll talk about that. And I was at a meeting and this person talked about his problem was not alcohol. Alcohol was his solution. And I thought alcohol was my problem. And when I heard that in that meeting in my first year, I thought, holy crap, that's it. Alcohol's not my problem. My problem is me. My solution is alcohol. And what his point was, is he'd been sober for a long time. He was pretty successful. But he didn't really start working the steps until, you know, close to his 10th year, really working it. He would substitute things in. Workaholism, materialism, sex, all these different things. And he kept finding that at a certain point he'd start to think about using a drink again. And he realized all these substitutes weren't going to help him. And he's like, well, why are other people happy, joyous, and free? What do they do that I don't do? And he realized they worked the steps. Because it's a solution that works when no other solution works. And he mentioned that, and I thought, that's it. Alcohol is my solution. When I'm sad, it makes me sadder, right? When I'm happy, it makes me happier. When I'm stressed, it calms me, right? When I'm tired, or when I'm not tired and I need to sleep, it puts me to sleep. It's my solution. It's not my problem. Once I realized that it was my solution and not my problem, it really helped. So I'm going along, and I believe this. In my present job, I really see it, and I'm not going to talk about a specific job, but I think that alcoholics and addicts are on a train to destruction, okay? And God stops that train at times and gives us an opportunity to get off the train. God won't stop you from getting back on the train, by the way. Think of like a first offense DUI, right? There's no prison, right? First offense DUI, learn my lesson, right? Second offense DUI, got to go to prison for 60 days. Okay, I got it now. Third offense, 90 days, right? Now I hit somebody, I injured myself. It just keeps getting ratcheted up, right? So I'm on this train in my last year. And what happened was, I go to my doctor, and he goes, I need to go get some internal MRIs and stuff. And I said, why? And he goes, well, when you first came to me, you weighed 180 pounds, blood pressure was good, your liver, your blood count was good, you now weigh 240, and you have high blood pressure, and your blood numbers are way off, and I think you have enlarged organs. So I go to he goes, well, do you drink? I'm like, occasionally. Because right? Why would I tell somebody I pay, right, who wants to help me? Why wouldn't I say, holy crap, I'm drinking all, no. Gotta lie to my doctor. Don't want him to think badly of me, right? Even though I'm paying him. And so he sends me off, and long story short, I did such a good job of lying about what was going on that they misdiagnosed me. They thought I had this disease called hematomicrosis, which is when you have too much iron in your blood and it causes liver problems, blood test. What I would do is I would hold off drinking about 2 days before I was getting my blood test, and then I'd have the bottle of vodka in the car, right? I'd go into LabCorp, get my blood test, walk right out and drink my vodka, right? And so they're like, well, he's not drinking. There's no alcohol in his system, so it must be hematomicrosis. So I went in for and I remember Hurricane Katrina in 2005. This is how I remember. I was in Christiana Hospital to get a biopsy on my liver, and right before I went in to get the needle pick, hurricane had hit New Orleans, and New Orleans had survived. It was no problem. And I went in and I got the biopsy done. I came out and New Orleans was gone. I mean, the levees had broken, so I know that's the day. And at that point, they diagnosed me with fatty liver disease on my way to cirrhosis, probably about 20% loss of my liver. And because they had diagnosed me with hematomicrosis, they didn't think about treatment for me. So what I was done was I was put on a pill and told to eat a certain diet and not to drink. And I thought, that's easy. I just won't drink. Right? And I said that, and I was sitting in my kitchen, and my wife was there, and she says she remembers me saying this. I said, what am I going to do without alcohol? And she said, it was, when I said it, I sounded like I'd lost a friend. So I go to about Thanksgiving, not drinking, and at Thanksgiving, I convince everybody that white wine is good for my liver. So, mid-December, I was back. And the way I describe from December to September is, I didn't get drunk, I stayed drunk. I couldn't say that. And if you're new, and you tell your story, and afterwards you say, like, gee, I don't know if I was 100% honest about my story, don't worry about it. You're only as honest as you can be about your story. Before, I would say I drank a lot. The reality is I drank a liter to a half gallon of vodka pretty much in a day and a half. What a functional alcoholic is somebody who operates on a 1.5 or 0.15. And they don't manifest drunkenness. Like I could drive a car and the police would never have pulled me over unless somebody hit me or I had a light out or something like that, because I could drive perfect. I functioned perfectly at 0.15. The problem is when you drop below 0.15 or you go above a 0.15, then you manifest your drunkenness. And so, it's going along in the last year. I had an office in New York and an office in Wilmington, and I knew I really was having a problem when I would change my liquor stores in New York City, which I don't even live in. And I walked into one of them, and there was a line, and the guy said, "Do you want your usual?" Okay, at 9 a.m., which was blue smeared off in plastic, because you don't want to use glass bottles, because if you drop a glass bottle, it'll break, and that's alcohol abuse. And so I would only buy plastic bottles, because I didn't want them to break. So I'm going along, and all of a sudden, my partners come up, and I'm not drinking around anybody, because I have liver disease, and only an alcoholic would drink if you have liver disease. So I could not drink in front of anybody. My wife did not even know I was drinking that much, which my counselor at Karen Foundation said I lied about. And then when he talked to her, he said, "Do you realize what a manipulator you are? Your wife did not know you were drinking at all before you told her that you had to go to the Karen Foundation." So my partners came in and said, "There's something wrong with you. We don't know what it is. We want you to go to a doctor. And we're not going to let you back until you go to the doctor." So I go home, and here's my first moment of clarity. Now would be a good example. If you're in a room like this, and it's dark outside, and there's light, and you look at the window, it's like a mirror, right? And I could see myself. And I just talked to my partners, and they were saying, like, "We found this doctor in California." I'm thinking, they're talking, Betty Ford. And I hung up the phone. They said, "We'll call you right back." And I hung up the phone, and I was looking at myself. And I said to myself, "I can get away with this one more time, but I can't stop drinking. I can't. I cannot stop drinking on my own. I am going to get in worse trouble. Remember, I have the facade, and I'm worried about what you think of me. So I've got to stop this problem before it really gets bad and you really hate me, right?" But I remember thinking that. Now I know that was God moment. That was my moment of clarity. That's when I got off the train of destruction, right? And now the question is, am I going to exercise free will and get back on that train, or am I going to follow that moment of clarity? So I'm sitting in there, and I have that epiphany. And the phone rings, and my partner's on the phone, and before they could say anything, I said, "Don't worry about the doctor. I have a drinking problem. I need help." And here was the amazing thing. The moment I admitted I had a drinking problem, and the moment I asked for help, everybody helped me. My partners helped me. My wife helped me. My dad helped me. Here I had all this fear that nobody loved me. And then everybody helped me. So I get into the Karen Foundation, and I stop drinking on the 17th, which I take it as unusual for rehabs. I didn't know that at the time. So I drive up to the rehab, and my wife drives me up, and I go in, and they test me, and they say, "You don't have any alcohol in your system." And I said, "Yeah, that's right. I'm at a rehab. I'm not supposed to have alcohol in my system." And they're like, "Well, there are people in the parking lot right now drinking before they come in here." So they tested me twice because they didn't understand why I didn't have alcohol. And so I didn't have to go through detox. That's miracle number two. I went straight to a bed. And here's the one thing I suggest, and I didn't do this, and I was talking about this today. I was at an event that raises money for the Lyman House in Wilmington. When I went to rehab, I had no desire to get better. I had a desire to stem the bleeding, right? I needed to get out of trouble, and this was the way to get out of trouble. So I went there to get out of there with a coin, right? Your completion chip. I didn't go there to get better. I remember sitting and trying to figure out how many days I had to go sober before I could start drinking again, because people would stop watching me, right? So at first I thought 60 days, and then I said, "Oh, this 90-90, so it's got to be 90 days. Then after I got out of rehab, I thought, well, 6 months, and then I settled on a year. If you go a year, they stop watching you, and you can start drinking again. So that shows you. I didn't walk in to Karen and say, I'm here for the solution, not the problem. Right? So here's the second big epiphany. I'm at the Karen Foundation, and you have to understand, I've never been to prison. I've never been to overnight camp. Okay? So I'm really dysfunctional in this type of situation. So I'm in this, and you know, they have this really high fence though to prevent the escape from Karen. It's about this high, and it's a white picket fence. And I feel like I'm in prison, and you have this, there's this asphalt walk area. It's a third of a mile long, and you have to walk the opposite way of women, and you have to have at least three people in your group, three men. And they have lots of different reasons for that. I don't know which one's right. But so at one point, 17th day at the rehab, and sorry, I have like a sciatic because I need to stretch a little, but 17th day, we're walking and we're heading back up to the main building. It's a little hill, and we had a pretty good group of guys. And the insanity was amazing. One guy in the group we were walking with wanted to be declared an alcoholic because he had had a seizure. And if he was epileptic, he couldn't get his license back. But if he was alcoholic, he could get his license. And another person was talking about which parts, you know, this God thing, they're trying to trick us, you know, and all this. And I'm in the service, and I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. I'm in Wernersville, PA, in prison, basically, for me. And I'm in the middle of, I'm walking this circle with a bunch of insane guys. And we think they're the problem, Karen. At that moment, I decided I was going to do everything they told me to do. That's a suggestion if you're new. What I would suggest, if you're worried about what, like, how am I supposed to know to do this, how am I supposed to know this, don't do that. Get a sponsor, find somebody who's happy, joyous, and free, walk up to them, ask them what they do to stay sober, and here's the trick. Do what they tell you to do. Okay? So I decided at that moment that I was going to do every single thing they told me to do, even if I didn't want to do it. So if they told me to walk up to that wall and say Hare Krishna three times, I'd walk up to the wall and say Hare Krishna three times. Why? I don't know. Because they told me. They know how to recover. I know how to drink. If they want to know how to drink, they'll ask me. If I want to know how to recover, I'll ask them. Right? So my thought was, like, I'm allowed to think as I walk up to that wall, this seems really stupid to me. But I still, you still have to walk up to the wall, Eric. You still have to walk to the wall, and you still have to say Hare Krishna three times. And so the next thing was Father Bill, who was the drunk monk at the time at Karen Foundation. He came in and talked to us on that same day. And there's, I can't remember what it was. There had been people who had laughed. There was some negative vibe. And he said, I'm sick and tired of you people. Don't you understand? We're going to give you the tools that are going to allow you to leave here and kick the disease's ass. I really think it's cool when a priest swears. So that was one good thing. But again, it made sense, right? Here I am walking into this thing, and I decide I'm going to do everything they tell me to do. And then a person tells me they're going to give me the tools. And I tried my sponsor. He's crazy. I am all about action. If you have a problem, I'm more than happy to listen to your problem. But then my next thing is going to be, now what are we going to do about it? And I loved that about the notion of using the tools to kick the disease's butt. Because I didn't want to be a couch potato. I didn't want to be a will-less person. You know that saying, he's taking his will back. I'd be like, I like my will. I don't, by the way, I don't think that's true. They talk about using your will in this book. They talk about it. You have to direct it in the right direction. Right? And what is that? It's easy. Primary purpose, stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. That's what you do. But I like the notion of action, and I started to realize that the program is all about, it's a program of action, not a program of inaction. So when I had heard the prayer and meditation part of it, I thought of it in the passive tense, not in the active sense. So I still didn't focus on that, but what I really liked was the notion that I was going to get tools, and I was going to use the tools, not have the tools use me, use the tools, and that would be the way. So, here's an example. I leave Karen. Don't you find that you learn the most from people that piss you off? Like my counselor said, now I need you to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And I said, I'll try and do that. He said, okay, so you're not going to do it. I'm like, No, I said, I'm going to try and do 90 meetings in 90 days. He goes, that means you're not going to do it. I said, I'm telling you, I'm trying to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And he goes, I hate to quote Star Wars, but when you try, you will fail. If you do, you will succeed. So if you tell me, I will do 90 meetings in 90 days, I'll believe you. If you say, I want to try to do 90 meetings in 90 days, it rained, my car had a low tire, my girlfriend yelled at me, I tried, I do it. So, but it really pissed me off at the time. Sorry, but it ticked me off. But those are the types of lessons. Like, I would talk in the royal we all the time. And one of the guys in my group said, will you stop talking about the royal we? Why don't you talk about yourself? Like, what did Eric do? Right? And so it was a pretty easy thing. I had to continue to read the big book, do 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, work the steps, go to intensive outpatient, and have a therapist. So that was basically my program. And here's an example. This is why I say just follow directions. Like, if you see somebody's happy, joyous, and free and has good sobriety, why are you questioning how they do it? You don't have any of those things, right? And so the notion is so I went to PACE, and I interviewed at PACE for my intensive outpatient, and they told me, well, you know, you went to the Karen Foundation, you have a really strong background. IOP is really for people who are first coming into things. So you can do outpatient. An outpatient is one night a week, no weekends. An intensive outpatient was three nights a week and every other weekend. And I said, no, my treatment program says I'm to do intensive outpatient for 6 to 8 weeks. I'm doing intensive outpatient. That's what I mean about I was doing everything they told me to do, right? other thing was, you're supposed to walk into a meeting, you get scheduled a meeting before you leave, and you walk in, you're supposed to ask for a temporary sponsor, and you're supposed to find somebody of the same sex, not a woman. And they wanted you to have somebody with like 2 years, but whatever. And, first meeting I walked into, there were nothing but women. So I'm thinking like, how am I supposed to ask for a temporary sponsor when they're all women? But it was a lunch meeting and it just didn't have a lot of men in it. So finally two guys came in and so I got a temporary sponsor. But that's what I'm talking about. I started in the process. I got a sponsor, which I didn't want to do, but I got a sponsor. And we started into the steps. And I think of talking about the steps. I first thought that I did my first step when I stood up in a meeting and said, I'm Eric, I'm an alcoholic. Isn't that an admission, right? And then it started to dawn on me that I used to admit daily that I was an alcoholic and my life was unmanageable and I drank vodka. So the words are all that it means. Why did I drink? Right? I mean, has anybody had the same thing? I mean, I would say, by the way, I didn't waste my money on the good stuff. I drank Pop Off, $6.99 a bottle, and I still find pennies every once in a while in old pants. But I remember saying, like, I can't stop drinking, and I'd walk right into the liquor store, I'm an alcoholic, and I can't stop this, and I would buy the Pop Off. So I started to realize, well, admitting I was powerless over alcohol is not enough. That can't be what the first step is. And so then the next first step I thought I had was I went to my doctor at 60 days, which is what Karen told me to do, get a physical. And he's like, wow, this is great. You've lost, you know, 20 pounds and your blood numbers are great. And I said, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, I've been in a rehab for 30 days. And he goes, and I said, I'm addicted to alcohol. And he goes, well, that explains a lot. And I made an amend to him because it was not his fault. I lied to him. I came out of that and I walked into the parking lot and I thought, you know, maybe I wasn't that bad. Maybe I'm not an alcoholic after all. And I was in that parking lot and I just started laughing at myself because I realized I was that bad. And I thought, okay, now I know I've done my first step. My first step to me now is what it is out of more on alcoholism in the first page and a half. To me, the first step is conceding to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic and that I cannot drink alcohol safely. And the key with the steps is I'm okay with that now. Before, I wasn't okay with it. See, to me, the trick with the steps is it's not just that acceptance is the answer. It's acceptance plus being okay with it. I can accept the fact that my mother is dead. I have no choice but to accept that my mother is dead. But am I okay with it? Right? That's the trick. If you're not okay with being an alcoholic, you're going to keep trying to be able to drink. But if you're okay with being an alcoholic, what's the big deal? And I started to think about lactose intolerance, right? A lactose intolerance person can't drink milk, right? It's no big deal. They don't go to dairies and buy a gallon of milk and drink it, right? An alcoholic will know he's an alcoholic and go drink alcohol, right? So we got to get okay with it. And that's what they're talking about. It's conceding to your innermost self. So my first step is conceding to my innermost self. And I didn't have that first step experience until after I'd done other steps, because I launched into a program of recovery, like it says in the book. And I don't know about other people. I kind of, my third step initially was I heard somebody say in a meeting, I used to question God all the time that there wasn't a God, and then I questioned God all the time that there was a God, and I couldn't prove one or the other, so I just quit worrying about it and just did what I was supposed to do. If you think about it, turning your will and your life over to the care of God or a higher power could be turning your will and your life over to the Karen Foundation, doing everything they tell you to do, or coming into AA and getting the sponsor and doing what your sponsor tells you to do. For instance, my sponsor said, go to a step meeting every week and a God step meeting every week. Go to big book meetings, right? Discussion meetings wasn't big on. He was big on the book. And I followed that direction, right? So every week I would do a big book meeting, two step meetings, and a God step meeting. Why? Because that's what my sponsor told me to do. It's really, I just turned it over, right? I understand it more now, but I had trouble. I was searching for what is God's will for me. And I was afraid. I was afraid that God would show up in that parking lot and God would tell me that he wanted me to go to the Himalaya Mountains and be some kind of weird monk with a hair shirt on. And what happens if I don't want to do that, right? So, in a certain sense, I was worried about what was God's will for me, right? And, again, I apologize, but it's just when you drive, your sciatica really goes on you. But I understand it differently. But what I did is I used substitution, just like they talk about in the 12 and 12, I used substitution. So that was my third step, and it worked just fine. I mean, some people would tell me, you know, you did a good start on 1, 2, and 3 the first time you walked into an AA meeting and you said you're an alcoholic. Because there you've admitted that you're powerless over alcohol and your life is unmanageable, right? Came to believe that a power greater than yourself would restore you to sanity, AA, right? That's why you're coming in asking for help. You want to be restored to sanity. By the way, sanity to me is the notion that I can drink normally, not that I'm clinically insane, but that I actually think that despite all evidence to the contrary, that I could drink. Throw up my stomach lining, esophageal hemorrhage, I can drink. Right? That's insane. It's insane. Drinking while you have liver disease is insane. But it's the insanity of being an alcoholic. And then, you know, made a decision to turn your will and your life over to care of a higher power of God was to me substitution. First Karen Foundation and then. Now here's the one that was tough. 4 and 5. Remember, if you knew me, you won't like me. Oh my goodness. I have to list everything out. I have to do an honest inventory. And I have to tell it to somebody. Right? And why do I have to do that? Because if I don't do that, I will drink again. I read that. I saw that in the big book. I saw that in the 12 and 12. It said people who have skimped on this step eventually have difficulty. So the reason I did 4 and 5 was because I didn't want to drink again. Not because of some, oh my gosh, I did the third step prayer and I'm now ready to do this. I didn't have that yet. I did that because I didn't want to drink again. And I read that if you don't do a fourth and fifth step, you'll drink again. All right? So this is in my first 6 months. And so the other thing I saw was that notion about skimping. And so I did it. Now, my suggestion, if you haven't done a fourth step yet, is don't worry about your fifth step when you're doing your fourth step. Right? Worry about your fifth step when you're doing your fifth step. When you do your fourth step, do it as if you're not going to do a fifth step. That way you don't hold anything back. Right? Because that's the thing that gets you sick, is the thing that you hold back. And so I heard that, and so I did my fourth step as if I wasn't going to do a fifth step, and then my sponsor and I did the fifth, and I had a wonderful experience with my fifth step, and my fourth step, actually. The thing that I discovered the most about my, I wasn't well enough to understand how many resentments I had, so my resentment list was short. Not because I was purposely leaving off resentments, but I was just too sick to understand. My fear list was pages long. Because I was told that, like, if you fear snakes, put snakes down. Right? It doesn't have to be something, you know, like I said, it doesn't have to be some great thing. It's what do you fear? Do you fear banks? Why? It's probably because you have low self-esteem and you're afraid that you go into the bank and they're going to ask you a question and you won't know how to answer it, right? You'll feel like you're a fool. Or you don't feel like you've saved enough money. All these terrible things, right? But it's a fear. It's an okay thing to say, well, you mean you listen to the bank? No, I listen to the bank. I'm afraid of banks. Phone, right? And then the sex part of it. And I did my fifth step, and I told things to my sponsor that I had never told to other people. And that my sponsor, he's really an AA guy. And I felt very comfortable telling that because I thought that if he ever told anybody off of my fifth step, he would know he'd go to AA hell. And so he would never reveal anything. So I felt very comfortable. But you should get somebody that you feel comfortable is not going to gossip about you or anything like that. And I had this, I felt so much relief after my fifth step. And then he told me, now do it exactly in the book. Go spend an hour alone, mortar and sand, just like it is on the page. And then do the sixth and seventh step prayer. And I'm looking forward to this, guys. Because remember, I have pages of fears. And now I'm going to have all my fears taken from me. Right? So I'm going to do my sixth and seventh step and all my shortcomings and character defects are going to be removed from me. And I did the prayer and nothing happened. Nothing. I had every single fear and every single character defect that I had before. Because there's a key to seven. It says, humbly ask him to remove our shortcoming. I was ready for Eric to decide that they would be going. Now, I'm at this point, I'm coming up to like 6 months. And again, remember I told you I went into treatment not to get better, but to like save myself, right, from any further fall. I wasn't trying to get healthy. I was just trying to stem the bleeding. So I liken it to the notion, like, I was pushing upstream. Like, I had no faith that I was going to be okay. I had no faith that I was going to be okay. Every day I would push upstream. I thought, like, if I showed up late, my sponsor would say, like, come to meetings early, stay late, right? So I would think, let's say traffic was bad. I'd be like, come on, I got to get to the meeting. If I get to the meeting late, I'll drink, right? I had no faith. I didn't understand that it takes effort to relapse. In other words, I'm not going to walk out of here and a bottle of vodka falls from the sky and lands in my mouth and I will drink it. I will actually have to drive somewhere with money in my pocket, pull in, buy the liquor, walk back out, and drink it. There's a lot of work involved in that, actually. But I thought the bottle was going to come and hit me in the mouth. I don't know if anybody else said this. I used to drive up and down this really kind of Miracle Mile strip mall thing called Kirkwood Highway, going to my pace. And when I was drinking, I would drive Kirkwood Highway and I would not see one liquor store on it. When I stopped drinking, when I drove Kirkwood Highway, I saw every single liquor store. They usually have liquor and yellow background and black lettering, blinking lights. And I thought, like, where did these all come from? Right? Because I had lack of faith and tremendous fear at this point. Even though I was at 6 months and I had a sponsor and I was working the steps, but hadn't developed faith. So I go to Reno, Nevada to do a trial by myself. And if you're from Reno, please take this the right way. Reno is what I call a soulless city. Not because of evil things there. Reno is like the northern Las Vegas. It's like San Francisco needed Las Vegas, so let's create Reno. Reno was a place where the Donner family, before they ate themselves, stopped to get water. It's not anything, right? And it's, again, I'm not passing there's legalized prostitution, all that. That's not the point. It's like, it's just there. Like, even a Rust Belt city, like, if you go to Reading, you'll feel the textile mills there. You'll feel the past. You go to Reno, it's like, so I'm in Reno, it's a 3-hour time difference, and I'm reading this book called Bill W. by Susan Cheever. Do not read that book. It is a depressing book about Bill Wilson. And when you're at 6 months sober, and you fear relapse, and you're alone in Reno, Nevada, the last thing you want to read is Bill W. by Susan Cheever. Her end of the story, this is so bad. She has him dying in his attic because he can't go up and down steps, right? So he's bedridden with oxygen. And she has him go into deliriums begging for a drink, right? And he couldn't go to meetings anymore because he was always being bothered by people. So I'm thinking, this is just effing great. I'm going to end up in an attic without any air, screaming for a drink. This is why I'm working Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. I can't. I mean, it's 3 hours difference, so I'm up at 3 a.m. I'm in an extremely stressful situation to do a trial. There's alcohol everywhere in Reno. You go down to the drugstore, they have alcohol. And I just had it. And I fell to my knees in my hotel room, and I just said, I can't do this anymore. Can you please help me? At that moment, I felt from the top of my head the stress drain from me. I just felt all the stress leave me. And I realized that I was going to be okay. Like, I was going to be okay. As long as I didn't drink and I didn't drug, God would take care of me. That I was going to be okay. I don't know why I had that feeling. I had a bright light moment, and I just knew at that moment that if I didn't drink and I didn't drug, that everything would be okay. It wouldn't necessarily be the way I wanted it to be, but it would be okay. Right? And so I say this to people all the time, like, you're going to be okay. How do you know that? If you don't drink or you don't drug, you're going to be okay. If you drink or you drug, all bets are off. So when people are going through problems, I say to them, like, trust me. The problem you have today will not be the problem you have 6 months from now. You'll have a whole new set of problems, guys. Life will happen. But if you don't take a drink or a drug, it will be because you will be moving on. You will move on. And I then had faith that I'd be okay. Like, I read How It Works. Everybody reads How It Works. How It Works to me is like a Wagnerian opera at the beginning. You stand at the turning point, you know, like lightning bolts are throwing, you know, all this stuff of abandon and all this thing and honest in 3 times in the first paragraph. And I would read that and I'd say, like, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it. And I'd hear people, and this is just my opinion. I would hear people come in and say, since I've come to AA, I've never found it necessary to tell a lie. Okay? So when my wife comes out and says to me, do I look fat in this? And she does. Am I supposed to say, yes, dear, you look fat in that? No, I say, I like you better in the other dress. That's a lie. But when I, after Reno, I read the second half of How It Works, which says, we're not saints. Progress, not perfection. Then I started to read the seven-step prayer differently. My Creator, I'm now ready that you should have all of me, good and bad. Not just good. My Creator, I'm now ready that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character that stands between me and my usefulness to you and to others. So when do my character defects get taken away from me? When I'm helping other people. Not when I want them to be taken away from me, but when I need to help somebody. So when I'm afraid to go somewhere in the city of Wilmington, if I'm going there to help somebody, like we pick up somebody for detox, I don't feel afraid. I feel like this is what we're supposed to do, right? Then I started to understand two things in my program that really started to help me, that really helped me with my third step. What is God's will for me? It's easy. It's really easy. God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. It says so. It says so in the book. It says God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. What's God's will? It's easy. Happy, joyous, and free. It's not that when I walk out of here that I turn right or left. God is not going to tell me to turn right or left. God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. So if I'm in a situation where I'm unhappy, unjoyous, and unfree, that is not God's will for me. What am I doing? And that's what's so important about 4 and 5. What am I doing so that I am not happy, joyous, and free? It helps me identify. Is it because I have self-centered fear going on? Am I lying because I'm afraid of losing something? Am I lying because I want to get something? Why am I doing this? Right? And so that the prayer changed for me. And I understood. And here, then all of a sudden it struck me. It's in the preamble, guys. What do alcoholics have to do? You have to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. There's God's will. Right? And if you, now when I read the third step, and I always suggest this to my sponsees, don't read the third step out of the 12 and 12. It's a very philosophical approach to the third step. Read the third step that's in the big book. It's super simple. God is your principal. You are his agent. Does everybody know what a principal-agent relationship is? It's a very big legal term. A principal-agent relationship is there is a boss, right? And when the boss tells you to do something, if you do what the boss tells you, legally you are protected. So if God is your principal and you are his agent, if you are doing God's will, then you are going to be okay. And if you think of God's will as staying sober and helping other alcoholics to achieve sobriety so that you're happy, joyous, and free, that's all it is to me. That's God's will for me. And that's, I mean, I tell people all the time, like, I still go to, what, 7, 8 meetings. I still survive, almost 12 years now. I still go to meetings. Why? Like, I'm the mouse in the maze that knows where the cheese is, guys. And I don't need to change the path, right? I always wonder, like, people say, like, I've been doing really well. I'm going to pull back on my meetings. Why? If you're doing really well, why would you change it? Like, if you're doing really bad, I understand why you're changing things. But if you're feeling really good, why would you change it? So I don't ever go back to the basics. I just stay with the basics. And the basics to me are, each morning I pray and I ask God to help me. And I pray for other people. And I go to a meeting and I read the big book and I sponsor people and I don't say no to AA. And it's really no more difficult than that. And I feel good. I mean, this is a life beyond my wildest dreams. Before, I had two guys come up with me, Teddy and Oliver. When I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I needed two people to drive with me to Quakertown, all my friends, I wouldn't have been able to find one person. And if even somebody said they would, at the last minute they'd cancel. I can't go anywhere without a full car now. I had to become a drunk and an alcoholic to have true friends. Isn't that cool? That's really cool. And I love, one of the things, and I'll end with this because we're 5 minutes, but one of the things, and probably drive my sponsors crazy, the phrase I can't stand is when people say, meeting makers only make meetings. Really? It's funny, because in a vision for you, all they talk about is meetings. Or one time I heard somebody say, there's nothing in the big book about meetings. I'm like, really? All they talk about is meetings and a vision for you. Remember what it talks about? It says, first they had the three, right? And then after a year and a half, I think they have 7 or maybe 10. But think about that. A year and a half of trying to get people sober. And the three of them got a whopping maybe 6 more guys, right? But they talk about they had informal gatherings every night. And once a week they had formal meetings. It says so. And then it talks about wanting to build a fellowship around you. And that's what, to me, AA is about. The Big Book is a text. It's not a novel. It's a text. It's our textbook. Okay? And it's, but if I came out of Karen and they had given me this Big Book, which they did, not this one, I wore out the first one, and told me, read this book and you'll get sober, I'd be drunk right now. Remember what I said before? Before I came to AA, I drank every single day. And since I've come to AA, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink. And to me, AA is the fellowship as driven by the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as memorialized in our textbook, Big Book. And so to me, meetings are fundamental. Now, you have to work the steps in order to be okay with it. But meetings are extreme. That's why we're all here tonight. So thank you for letting me share.